You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. My first guest today is Kazuo Ishiguro. My second guest will be Oscar Ijuelos. Ishiguro is the novelist who recently wrote The Remains of the Day, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Some of you may remember that he has been on the show before, and it's because I love this book that I have chosen to talk to him again. The novel is about a butler in the days after the fall of the English butler, ruminating about his service for Lord Darlington and about the kind of world that has produced him and now, to some extent, ejected him. This book is also about love, in a sense, and in some way the unexpressed love for Miss Kenton, what is her post?
She's a housekeeper.
Yes.
Well, she was a housekeeper.
And he's thought of her for many, many years after she's left the house, has tried to think of some way to bring her back, and now he thinks he's found one. His unexpressed love for Miss Darlington mirrors, perhaps, his inexpressible love or devotion to Lord Darlington. It's as if the greatest passions, such as they are, that he have, sort of mirror each other in their silence. And so this is a book where great amounts of comedy as well as passion get expressed off stage, as it were. I'm trying to locate the question here, which has to do with how do you express an inexpressible love as a writer?
Well, I guess by trying to portray all the tensions surrounding the lack of expression. And the portrait of Stevens in this book is, a lot of it is just that. It's about a man who, for some reason, has forbidden himself to love. But there's still a very, very strong force in him that demands that he remain a human being, despite all his best efforts to turn himself into something else. You know, in fact, into the perfect butler, which by his definition is less than human. This book takes place during a few days, during which Stevens takes a very rare holiday. And suddenly there's time to think and time to feel and time to reflect back over his life. And this very painful idea comes over him that he has wasted his life, and that he has wasted his life in various ways. But in one key respect, he has not seen through that emotion, that side of him that was capable of love.
The last thing one would expect of a book like this is that it would also be, in a way, a political book, and yet this human's nature reflects and in its tiny way impinges on political actualities. How much were the political aspects, Lord Darlington, for different reasons, eventually becomes a Nazi sympathizer, and his butler believes enough in Lord Darlington to be willing to think that if perhaps Lord Darlington may or may not be right, but since it is Lord Darlington is right. Is the political sense of the book its base or subordinate in some sense to it?
Certainly when I was planning the book, it was a very fundamental part of the structure. In fact, one of the reasons I decided to write through a character of a butler was because that provided me with a key metaphor. And that metaphor was this, that I wanted to say something about the relationship of the small, ordinary person to political power. And I suppose in some sort of way I was suggesting that there is something of the butler in most of us. We do not usually get a chance to run governments or lead coup d'etats. Most of us just learn to do a small, rather peripheral thing well. And then we offer up our little contribution to some cause or organization or employer and hope for the best, that our little contribution is used in a way that we would approve of. But often we just do not know. The political and moral responsibility is usually held somewhere else, and we just sort of tap into some system and hope that our life and our life's work will look okay when we look at it from a wider perspective. And that's really the position Stevens adopts. He says, and I think it's a very dangerous one politically, but he says, look, I'm just a butler. I don't understand about world economics and diplomacy and military strategy. I'm just a butler. And the only way someone like me can contribute to great affairs is really to just serve a great man who does know. But of course, unfortunately for him, he trusts in the wrong man. He trusts in the man who ends up collaborating with the Nazis.
At a certain point, driving through a village where he's not known, the butler, Stevens, is assumed to be a great lord himself, and he impersonates not exactly his master, but a friend of his master's. Am I correct in that?
Well, yes. I mean, that's all his life Stevens has lived with this great ambition to contribute to the cause of humanity. And of course, this has been impossible because he's just a butler. But almost accidentally, when he's traveling around, he's presented with this little moment when he can just pretend that he was this powerful figure, that he's not a butler, but he was this man who straddled, you know, world policy and debated with Churchill and so on. And because the villagers actually mistake him for such a figure, he just cannot resist but just allow them to believe this for a few moments at least. And he allows himself this small indulgence, or just for a few moments, believing that he is this other greater figure, somebody who did contribute to history in a big way.
Reminds me of that great and really uproarious moment in Great Expectations when Pip, having been for the first time to the great lady's house, to Miss Havisham's house, can't resist boasting a bit to his adoptive father, the blacksmith, Joe Gargery. And Gargery, lost in admiration, says, "Was there lamb chops, Pip?" And Pip says, "There was lamb chops, Joe." There's a kind of great, I don't know, what is it? The agony of yearning, the agony for a world that you suspect you may have only imagined. And in this case, it turns out that it's a world that, in fact, Stevens has helped create, that he's always stage-managed.
Yes, yes, precisely. I mean, I suppose in a sense, I mean, you could call Stevens an unreliable narrator. I mean, that's a device that's often used in much more overtly postmodernist novels than mine, I suppose, to draw attention to the nature of fiction and fictionality. But that kind of thing doesn't interest me too much, but I'm interested in unreliable narrators in relation to what you've just said. It's a way of portraying the way people make up stories about themselves, the way they twist around memories to come up with a perspective on their own lives that they can find acceptable. I like to follow the ways in which they lie to themselves and the ways in which they demand honesty of themselves. And yes, I'm very interested in that whole process.
People always do like to become heroes of their own story, and yet it's Stevens's lot to have decided to become, what would you call it, the servant in his life story, you know, someone whose destiny has been to prepare the center of the stage for someone else. And yet during this sabbatical trip about England, where you have the sense of also a vanishing world bursting in on the consciousness of someone who's not ready quite to perceive it, it feels like the reason why he's thinking so much of Darlington, who is already dead and gone, is because he has to hold off the sights of his vacation. Not many of them can reach him, and so it's not until the end of the book that the world as it is, as he's been seeing it and avoiding it, begins to intrude or obtrude in his consciousness.
Yeah, yes, I think that's accurate. I mean, he's all the time he is struggling to keep one vision of the world in place, one fiction about the world, if you like, in place, long after it's sustainable. And I don't actually structure my novels around plot lines so much as these kind of movements of consciousness. I actually sort of plan out beforehand how somebody's what level of self-deception a person is at, and my books are often structured by the central character letting go one after the other certain cherished notions about his world, and because the outer world starts to invade.
You mentioned that some of these techniques in this novel are used to different purposes by postmodernist or metafictional writers whose desire to show the workings of the plot and to derealize the fiction is the primary desire. And it is interesting to see these techniques in the service of a very skewed and gradually seeping emotion, since it is emotion that these other books are at pains to avoid. Are there any of the postmodernist writers whose works you admire, though?
Not really, no. I don't know who exactly you mean. I mean, this label postmodernist is a very loose one, and I'm not quite sure who we're applying it to, but I mean, I would say in general that questions about the nature of fiction, the reflexiveness of fiction, books that say to the reader, look, you're only reading a book. Don't be silly, you weren't reading anything very true. This is just a fabrication. I think there's room in the world for two or three books that say that. But I just do not, I mean, personally, it is not for me. I mean, the nature of fiction is not for me one of the kind of the great burning issues of the late 20th century. And it's, you know, I wouldn't actually devote a book to exploring it. But if we are actually talking about postmodernism in the sense that we're saying that novels have come to recognize the extent to which people do make up versions of the world for their emotional or political needs, then we're talking about something much deeper, much more profound. And as I said before, if you're talking about how people lie to themselves and why people make up a certain version of their past rather than another, right, if we're talking about postmodernism in that sense, yes, then I'm very interested indeed, because I think that's a very important thing.
People usually point to Nabokov as the example of self-obsessed aestheticism, and yet it seems to me that in Humbert Humbert, the hero of Lolita, there is a hero like the narrating figure in your book whose lack of self-knowledge is itself immensely revealing, and whose drift through brutality, in his case, to a kind of evanescent consciousness is the moving, the human center of the book. It was very interesting to see what are often regarded as aestheticized techniques being used to such human purpose in The Remains of the Day.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, you know, Lolita is a book I admire a lot, precisely because I think that's an example of a book in which postmodernist assumptions have been applied to human concerns, unlike some books which is basically a bag of tricks to pull the carpet from underneath the reader to make what I think is an obvious and banal point that, you know, the reader is reading a book. I mean, Nabokov does a lot more than that, and I think, I think it has to be applied. These assumptions, these techniques have to be applied to things that are genuinely important.
Thank you, Kazuo Ishiguro, author of The Remains of the Day, recently published by Alfred A. Knopf, for joining us once again in the studio.
Thanks very much indeed.
My second guest today is Oscar Ijuelos, the author of the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love, his second novel, recently published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. This is a book that combines history of the Cubans in America with the history of Cuban music in America, the mambo, the merengue, the world of the dance clubs in New York, the Sanssouci. Is this a novel written from experience of those clubs, of that world?
Well, first thing I would say is that I started writing the book out of an awareness of the music, having listened to that, to those old mambo records and cha-cha records when I was growing up, and sort of having a fictional idea of what these characters were like. But there was also music on the streets where I was growing up. There was a lot of Latin music, bands playing a lot in churches and schools, at street fairs, also bands rehearsing in apartments. And the interest grew from the music and just developed. I ended up interviewing musicians who performed in that era. I ended up hanging out a lot with people who went to the dance halls. So in a way, I think it's a combination of many things made that the subject.
It's about two brothers, the Castillo brothers, Cesar and Nestor, and they are the Mambo Kings, whose music brings them to an appearance, the height of their career, on I Love Lucy. Lucy and Ricky have them to the house. They're two cousins from Cuba, and they make an appearance at the club, at least according to the book, on one of those evenings that Lucy is trying to sneak on to the show again.
As usual.
Yes, as usual. Is it the one where she's the cow?
No, it isn't. It's completely made up.
Uh-huh.
But I sort of used the cow image because, in my mind, it had something to do with the bull image, which is what Cesar Castillo is about. He's a very macho, bullish sort of man in some ways. So it sort of emanated from that. And it turns out that it gives the episode in the book a ring of truth, because I've met a lot of people who've said they've seen the episode.
Yes, I felt like I had seen the episode, and yet at the same time, I felt, well, no. it couldn't be. Now, it's odd, because on the one hand, while that suggests a kind of comic novel, in fact, the novel tends to be a kind of moody, poetic, brooding, tropical novel, owing more to, say, Lorca or Neruda than to pop culture.
Mm-hmm. It's a sad wolf's in sheep's clothing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a wolfish novel in the sense that it has a lot of chops, it has strength, it has cunning, the people in it have all these qualities, but it's also sad. I mean, I was really interested in sadness when I was writing it, but I was also interested in the question of how does a writer balance the pain in the book? In this world, the pain is balanced by a lot of lovemaking, a lot of music, the love of music, and the love of people.
It's interesting because for these characters, the height of fame is their moment on I Love Lucy, and it's a tragic moment because, after all, here the brothers come, bringing with them the remainders of a lost and vanishing culture, and their moment of fame comes on a situation comedy where there they are with Lucy and Ricky and Ethel, and, you know, you feel the triviality of a civilization. Structuring the novel, it must have felt sometimes a very unwieldy thing to keep aloft.
Yeah, it was a bit of a problem, but I wanted to use the episode as sort of a takeoff on the idea of reoccurring memory, and the rerun seemed an appropriate enough vehicle for that. But the other thing is, it gives the novel a kind of structure. Although one part of the novel structure is almost musical, and the other is the I Love Lucy show as being a reoccurring element in it. And I have to say, I placed it, when I was writing the book, I placed it in different spots. I tried different approaches, and using the episode over and over again tended to be a decent thing, because each new time that you came to it, it seemed to have a different kind of... It meant something different. I mean, it's quite different when one of the characters is alive and well, and it means quite a different thing when that person is gone. And it means even more when he's been gone for 20 years.
I've been telling friends who ask me about the book that I have never seen as many penises en route to wet vaginas in one book.
Wait now, until you see the next one.
another record broken. But there seems to be some kind of play, not always playful, on Latin machismo.
Mm-hmm.
What has been the response to that? I found it kind of shocking and funny at the same time.
Well, I intended it to be a bit on the Rabelaisian side. But on the other hand, men are... At least some of the men I know are so unbearably, incredibly insecure and at the same time egotistical that... When I was starting to write about the sexuality in the book, instead of mincing it, as so many American writers do, I mean, it's very limp, a lot of the American writing about sex, so I said, well, let's go for virility. The response has been, I got a call one night in my apartment from a Latin band leader named Larry Harlow, who's a very good man, and he said, you got the story of the machos down right. But he used to say that you conveyed a true portrait and of that kind of macho musician who womanized in public. And I've gotten a response from Cubans, which is that you really captured the Cuban sensuality, which until now, I guess, has been pretty much under the covers.
But at the same time, in say, Lorca's play, La Casa de Bernarda Alba, mm-hmm. the stallions are out in the barn. Mm-hmm. On stage are the women in a white, sort of frigid world, while the stallions are steaming and stamping off stage. Mm-hmm. There is in Spanish literature almost an epic lyric poetry of the man giving off steam and the world of women turning to the church in order to evade him.
One could say that, but I don't think that's the case of the society in Cuba as it was. And as it is, I mean, I was in Miami just the other night, and it's really a jumping town. And I met a lot of writers there. Most of them were female, and they said they loved the book. They could really relate to it. They said, you got it down right. And they say, you have a lot of chutzpah, but you got it right. I can see how it could be misinterpreted, but it was well-intended. And as I say, it was meant to parody, to a certain extent, macho, but it was also meant to balance the pain in the book. And what else would a man who's really worried to death about mortality and worried about a loss of love in his life, what would a man who is in a state of pain really dwell on except those points of exquisite pleasure? And who knows if he exaggerates it in his own mind?
Like your fellow Cuban writer, Cabrera Infante, the language of this book takes the foreground. It's often... the hero of the book, the language attempting to approximate music. to give a sense of the representative tone of the book and some of the throw-off, show-off qualities of the language, I thought I would ask you to read the section in which you talk about drumming. Here, a section from the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love. This is César, the old Mambo King, remembering the sound of drums playing in the clubs at night and all the things that those drums announced.
And now nothing but drums, a battery of drums, the conga drums jamming out in the descarga, and the drummers lifting their heads and shaking under some kind of spell. There's rain drums like pitter-patter, pitter-patter, but 100 times faster, and then slamming the door drums and dropping the bucket drums, kicking the car fender drums. Then circus drums, then coconuts falling out of the trees and thumping against the ground drums, then lionskin drums, then the whacking of a hand against a wall drums, the beating of a pillow drums, heavy stones against a wall drums, then the thickest forest tree trunks pounding drums, and then the mountain rumble drums. Then the little birds learning the fly drums, and the big birds alighting on a rooftop and fanning their immense wing drums. Then a boat down the river with its oars dropping heavily into the water drums. Then a man coupling with a woman and jamming the bed frame into the wall drums. And then someone jumping up and down on the floor drums. And then a fat man slapping his own belly drums. And then a woman smacking her ass down on the floor drums. And then Morse code drums. And then the sky breaking up and all the heavens falling down drums. And then a bap 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 like dialogue drums. And children running through an empty church drums, and a conquistador firing cannons at an Indian village drums, then slaves being thrown into the hold of a ship, the heavy weather-worn oak doors crashing, clumsily shut drums, and then the beating of pots and pans drums, and then lightning drums, and then an elephant rolling on the ground drums, and then heartbeat drums, and a hummingbird drone drums, and then tick-tock and stop drums, then a hurricane through the shutters of 100 houses drums, then the jalousies flapping in the wind drums, and sails pushed by a sudden gale, and breast pumping against a male stomach, the sweat farting through the belly buttons drums, rubber trees bending drums, forest winds blowing, blackbirds flying through the high branches drums, plates and coffee cups shattering in a pile drums, wild natives banging on a row of human skulls, bones flying through the air drums, and beat on the tortoise shell drums, beat on a fat wiggly ass drums, Chinese chimes drums, and men hitting men drums, belts hitting faces drums, thick branches against the back drums, and then rapping coffin drums, all drums, bata, conga, bongo, quinto, tumbadora drums, booming like thunder clouds, beautiful women shaking their life-giving hips drums, a million bells falling out of the sky drums, a wave assaulting the earth drums, comparsa lines twisting through town drums, celebrational marriage drums, firing squad drums, a man moaning with orgasm drums, and shouting, yawning, laughing, crying drums, drums from across a field and deep in the forest, the drums of madmen on stage letting loose. Good old Pito on the timbales and Benny on the congas for a little 10-second interlude in the middle of one of those old Mambo Kings songs.
That from the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love by Oscar Hijuelos, a novel full of memory and excesses, published just recently by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This has been Michael Silverblatt on Bookworm. My engineer has been Bob Carlson. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.